Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm really excited to have Andreas eAudio here and from AIK, CEO. And yeah, really impressed with what you've accomplished. 200-300 lectures a year. And you write for MIT, Technology, The Colonist, Wired. Three books that I know of. I guess your latest book is Between You and AI. You have the most popular podcast on NVIDIA in Brazil. And yeah, just amazing things you've already accomplished and really happy to have you on the show. And maybe you can do a better job introducing yourself as well.
Thank you, Dean. You pronounced my name very well. So congrats, because it's not an easy one. I'm originally Italian. You can guess it by the accent. But I've lived for 10 years in Brazil after I graduated in the US. I'm an economist from Johns Hopkins University. But I've never worked with that. I actually pivoted to technology. I started working at Groupon first and then Tinder. I was the head of Tinder in Latin America for 5 years. And then I was the chief digital officer at L'Oreal. And just before the pandemics, I started doing as a side hustle, like keynote speaking. I really loved stepping on stages. And that went well to the point that it became my full-time job. And now I'm a full-time keynote speaker traveling around the world and working with companies at their events and inspiring their people and trying to teach them a bit about digital transformation, AI. But most of it, it's about the human transformation that is behind all of these tech trends. And such a pleasure being here, Dean, and eager to talk more about all of these topics.
Yeah, I tell you, what's critical for all of us is human AI collaboration, building teams, getting rid of the fear of this whole replacement narrative, in my opinion. And anyways, what I thought was really interesting, maybe you could share some information. I loved it that you talk about tech, the intersection of tech, behavior, neuroscience, psychology, and then how does AI intertwine into all that, interwove into all that? Because that's actually one of the most critical things, in my opinion, of all of us to keep growing and driving our business forward is figuring all that out.
Totally, Dean. Because if we look at, first of all, the way that AI works, it's totally fundamental on the way that our brain works. So if we don't understand neuroscience, we won't understand the way that AI makes decisions. And that actually is a big problem because nowadays we don't really grasp how AI works. And this leads to transparency issues and a lot of topics that we can further dive deep into. But the point here is I really position myself, well, beyond, of course, the passion that I have in these topics, in this intersection, neuroscience, philosophy, behavioral economics, which is my specialty from university, because I think most of the talk around AI is very tech focused, which is, of course, important. But one of the reasons why AI projects fail, and the MIT Media Lab recent report showed that 95% of them fail within big organizations, is because we neglect this human aspect. We don't train the people in the right way. We don't actually position AI as a co-pilot, but people see it as a threat. And so if we don't work on what are the nudges for people to adopt AI, how we can better craft the UX so that people find it easy to collaborate with, and a whole lot of other topics that are much more on the behavioral and human side than on the tech side, then we won't have a real successful AI transformation, but we'll have an AI substitution. And that's exactly what we don't want. And so I know you, Dean, have the same vision, and I think it can be scary if we keep on behaving the same way as we did in the past, but with such a powerful technology that is much better at replacing many of our tasks and skills. And that's a problem we're seeing now.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is like we do UX for developers and designers and building commercial apps. And there's a whole new, I don't know if you want to comment, there's a whole new UX, and you just can't be chat and LLM. You're going to be like everyone else. And so it's hard now how to like bring all that into the user experience digitally. Do you have any thoughts around that? Like how do you design more for human interaction, leveraging LLM intelligence, but then the whole UX kind of experience?
There's a great study actually, Dean, that has been made on what are the levers that make people find AI more as a collaborator rather than a threat. And there's two dimensions to it. There's the cognitive dimension and the emotional dimension. The cognitive is how well do I understand how AI works and how friendly is the interface? I'm getting to the UX part in a second. The emotional is how much do I trust AI? And how comfortable emotionally do I feel when I use AI? And so when we work on these levers, actually, these have the highest correlation, positive correlation to successful AI adoptions in organizations and teams. And so getting back to the UX part, which is one of the very important cognitive levers, do I find it easy? Is it easy to navigate, to collaborate with AI? What are we seeing is that actually the UX part is more and more important. And not only in the mainstream LLMs, we're seeing, of course, ChatGPT and Gemini being more seamless, very easy to interact with, which, by the way, was a problem with the whole Web3 movement because it was as powerful, very powerful, but it was very hard for you to buy terrain, like maybe a domain or buy an NFT. Not everybody was able to do it because the UX was not as good. And now, when we're seeing smaller language models or private language models being more and more used and developed within organizations, we're seeing a very big focus in an UX that is easy to interact with, that is conversational, second big point, and that is more human, which gets us to the emotional aspect of AI adoption, the second big lever that I've said. So whenever we work on these aspects, that's also one of the reasons why AI adoption is on the rise, because again, it makes it much more easy and much more friendly to interact with.
Yeah, that's great. Great answer. Yeah, could you share a little bit of like some of what you talk about on your lectures? Because you talk about innovation and human behavior. And like, how can people like, what can you maybe share here with the audience that will help them navigate their go-to-market, how to integrate AI, whether they're building product or trying to drive growth in their company? Yeah, what can you share about that?
Basically, Dean, the core of my work and also the core of the topic of my latest book, Between You and AI, is always around the skills that are needed to better use AI and also not to be substituted. So I always start, and especially in this book, mapping out what AI does best when it comes to specific tasks and skills. And it's very easy to note that AI is very good at substituting and is becoming better than humans in all of those tasks that have familiar patterns, that are repetitive, that have a lot of outcome data. Namely, if you're able to see positive or negative outcome, you're able to train the model. And these, if we generalize, are usually tasks related to our hard skill, to our knowledge-based skills or many cognitive skills or the skills that you study a lot for, and so on. What AI cannot substitute is actually the soft skills part, which are harder to measure. How do you measure empathy? How do you measure if an employee is collaborative or not? And that's where AI cannot be actually trained. That's one of the aspects of it. And the second one is that because of the fact that AI has no conscience so far, up until we develop a sentient AI, but we're still far from there, AI will not be able to actually have an understanding of what's going on. And therefore, no ethical boundaries, no transparency, cannot explain its decisions. And that's where humans thrive. And so, basically, the core of my keynotes and work is what are the new skills and what are the new tasks and what is the new culture that we have to implement within organizations in order to better cooperate with AI and with an AI that is more and more agentic, namely more proactive, with bigger responsibilities and more autonomous? And how do we also, at the same time, set the boundaries and train our people? I think that's really the essence of the work that I do.
Yeah, that's a super important work. This is a difficult question, but I share the point of view. Do you think the AI the future of AI is just going to be replacing jobs? Or do you think like the future of AI is it's a collaborator, it augments the whole team, it's another member on the team to achieve whatever outcome you're looking to do? Like I feel it's the latter. That's my point, is I'm taking a stance on the latter, but at least where it is now. Maybe it's not a fair question, but what are your thoughts there?
No, it's a super interesting question. It's almost like the million-dollar question, right? Because in a sense, it's really what will make the difference in with apocalyptic scenarios and a positive outcome. What I would say is that I'm also leaning towards the second scenario, that is a collaboration scenario, but it really depends on us and on what we do now within our organizations and as leaders. Let me get to the substitution aspect. So a lot of people are afraid that AI is coming for their jobs, is coming for their skills, but AI is actually coming for some of our tasks. And yeah. Tasks and skills and tasks and jobs are very different.
Yeah.
So we make the mistake of associating substitution to an entire job. But let's look at our job descriptions, right? There's a number of tasks, and some tasks are definitely going to be substituted. But you know what? That's actually good news, because we will end up saving time and being more productive, more efficient, being able to focus on things that add more value to our job and so on. The problem, though, is with the jobs that have a very high percentage of tasks that can be substituted. These are the jobs that are the biggest, most at risk. And so we look at, I don't know, supermarket cashiers. It's a good example. Most of those tasks can be substituted and replicated. But look at a supermarket cashier that asks to the customer, how was their day, how they're feeling. That's the part that cannot be substituted. And I'm actually giving a circle in this answer, which is getting back to your initial point. We will not be substituted, but be complemented only if we do the right things now. That is, if we start to reshape our job descriptions and the way we see work, introducing more and more human aspects to it. And that's exactly what will make our job unsubstitutable. Yeah. And if I'm a supermarket cashier, or if I'm a bank teller, or if I am like a nurse or a phlebotomist, actually phlebotomist is a job that according to Microsoft will be the least substituted, because no AI will be able to calm you down when, you know, they're trying to extract blood from you for some testing.
I don't even know what that job was.
That's the point, right? I've learned it through Microsoft's research. And so the point here is it really depends on us. And what I mean by us is, of course, us individuals, but especially us leaders, in looking at our organization, looking at areas, looking at our people, and trying to understand, of course, what are the tasks that can be automated? What are the tasks that can be augmented, that is not substitution, but is in enhancing the quality of human work? And the third thing is what we do with the time that we gain back, because that also makes a difference. And that is the answer to these three points is what leads to collaboration, because if we don't think or we neglect that, that's what will lead to substitution.
Yeah, I love that answer. I think the narrative has to change out there, because if you ask leaders, how valuable is culture, or how valuable is like intuition, or how valuable is the outcomes of collaboration to solve a problem? It needs to be AI as a team member. It can't be just AI. And like, how do you have competitive advantage if everyone has the same AI? And how do you, and competitive advantage is not just features. It's that emotional experience. And it's that nuance of the cashier register having seen that you're having a good or bad day. And that's what we all talk about, culture, and which we work so hard on. And that's where psychology comes in. And anyways, I just want to like project that, you know?
You've mentioned also something super interesting, which is the commoditization of skills. And if we all use the same AI tools, what will differentiate us?
Yeah.
That's exactly the point. Like what we do with the time we gain back and how human we make some of our tasks. And so you nailed the point. Yeah.
Yeah. And a bad outcome is that people don't, like for me, I care about people studying engineering, certainly computer science, but all engineering. If we dumb down our next generation and they don't study these hard skills and go through the trial and error of learning and experiencing and experimenting, man, we're in like, and that's like a bad narrative now. Cause like, I know I have friends who tell their who are in computer science and running software companies, oh, don't study computer science, you don't have a future, which is so wrong. It's not the truth, but that's some narrative going on out there. And I don't know, I don't like that. I don't know if you have a point of view there, but.
It's like with calculators in the 80s. Did they take away the need to study math? No, by the contrary, but it reshaped the way we study math. And so that's the point. We still need to have, of course, like a control of some knowledge domains and study. But the thing is that also we need to be able to extract those through the tools better than others. And so that's why prompting is important. Understanding data sets is important, whether they're biased, they're complete or not, and so on. So I think there's a whole new set of skills that are related to how well we use AI. And so that will also make a difference because we already have the same AI tools available. And that's why you see on LinkedIn, all of a sudden, everybody's creating content and they were not. So it reduced the friction, it reduced the barrier from ideation to execution. And oddly enough, I'm always wondering, are we then getting back to a world that prioritizes ideation, so creativity and so on? Or are we getting to a world that, I don't know, again, prioritizes humanization? I don't have all the answers, but definitely if we only think that it's just executing, it's tough because everybody else has the same access to the tools. But yeah, it's maybe too philosophical.
You get a lot of AI slop out there and you get a lot of amazing creativity, but that's the world we are in. So like where we are now, people need to know, like, just use the tools, know where they're at and don't dumb down the hype to be productive now. I mean, sorry, I'm not asking you questions, but I just wanted to share that.
Of course.
Can I take you back to your past a little bit, which is an amazing accomplishment? Like you made through Tinder, you made them the second biggest users country in the world, which is like amazing. And so like we have a lot of go-to-market people figuring out how to grow their business and go-to-market. What can you share how you did that? And then if there's any sprinkling of today AI of go-to-market in there or something.
Sure. It was like almost 10 years ago. And Tinder recently had launched and I was managing Brazil, which is a very big country already in population, but nowhere near the US. It's 220 million people. But the point is that what we really nailed was a couple of factors. The first thing is we understood that, especially in the social world, the snowball effect, the network effects are very important. So we understood that the more people we had on the platform, the more we'd be able to attract. And so we really focused on creating this momentum around some very special events, such as the, for example, the World Cup in Brazil in 2014, the Rio Olympics in 2016. We really activated our user base during those dates to basically grew the number of users to a point that it would become so interesting, such a big FOMO for people who were not on the platform that they would join. This is one of the aspects. The second aspect is that we were always looking at...
Follow up about that?
Please.
That's a big bet. It sounds like you bet on two huge events. And that's a big bet. Like it either works or doesn't. And then what were the details of activating people around those events? So, sorry to interrupt you.
No, please. The thing around those events was the following. We understood that as part of a global app, we had to go beyond our sort of like scope. So of course I was managing Brazil, but I had to understand that a lot of foreigners were coming into Brazil to watch the games, to watch the Olympics. Some athletes even were using Tinder. So I had to focus also on the international side of the business to grow Brazil, to grow my country. And so we were cooperating with a number of other countries to activate users before they would travel to Brazil. So that was also very smart because it created that sort of like hype around these events. And again, press would then take on like the news that some athletes were on the platform. It would create this momentum. And the interesting thing is that after these events, the number of users wouldn't drop back, but it actually would stay steady because so many new people got into the platform that they were retained by it and they would become loyal. And they were like not just one-time users, but they would just stay, maybe had an initial reason to join the platform, which was these big events, but then would stay on and become loyal customers. And so it was a big bet, but it definitely worked out.
So was it like, what was the messaging? Like, you're going to come to this world event, meet somebody that you can enjoy it with or something? Or was, I don't know what.
Yeah, it was like Tinder would position itself. And up until now, although I'm not part of the company anymore, would position itself as a social discovery platform. What you end up getting from it, it really depends on you. And of course, on the other people you meet along the way. And so social discovery would mean learning a new language, or there's stories of people having landed a job through Tinder. Of course, maybe like the date didn't work out, but you just meet someone who would, that's the point. And so the messaging was much broader than just relationships. And I think that's also one of the factors that, first of all, broke down the stigma that any dating app usually has at the beginning. And the second thing would increase our potential user base, which was also very important, because when you want to have network effects, you want to have a lot of people on the platform.
Yeah, that's smart. It's hard. Growth is hard. Network effects are hard. You have to get to a certain number of invites to get ahead of the drop off. It's all hard. Like, you can read any book and it seems easy. You can know all your metrics. It is not easy.
That's total true. Totally true.
I'm curious. I don't know if you do work in this area. Do you have any tips? Share some experiences around AI and go to market, or just go to market in general. Like, everyone's trying to grow their business. And any tips around that area?
I would say that overall, not getting too much into the specifics of it in the technical part, is focusing on how the hyper-personalization that you can get through AI will improve your retention metrics. So let me step back. So I really believe and really have put in practice, and it worked at Tinder and in other endeavors, and I now do work with companies along this way, is people don't want anymore to buy a product or a service, but they look for experiences. Because again, products and services, it's commodities nowadays. If you think about it, there's lower access, and there's lower barrier to entry in markets, so there's much more providers of the same things. The customer has infinite access to information. They can compare, review, compare prices. They have lower switching costs, because if I'm not satisfied with my bank, in one click, I can open an account at another bank. So it's not anymore user acquisition that makes a difference in growth. What really makes the difference is user retention, loyalty, advocacy. So down in the bottom part of the funnel. And I see too often, up until today, projects that fail because they are great at acquiring users, but their product does not have retention. Their product does not generate this good experience that make people want to stay on the platform or buy back or talk about the great experience they've had. And AI steps in as a great tool to craft great experiences and to create these memorable moments that basically are shaped by the best experiences that people have with their product and service. For example, people now look for omni-channel experiences. They look for instant gratification. They look for low friction, hyper-personalization, transparency. AI can provide all of that. And so if we understand, of course, that AI is a great tool for that, but also if we understand that the data, the customer data, is key for AI to actually work, because again, we need to train the model. We need to have the model be responsive in real time and with accuracy to the way that the customer interacts with it. And so I think it's an understanding, okay, AI is a great tool to improve the experience, but at the same time, we have to have the data ready. And that's a great scenario where I think growth can be not only achieved, but sustained. And I think growth sustainment is even harder than achieving it or having the momentum.
Yeah. And sometimes we struggle with this. Like, you measure the wrong thing, it's not good. Like, we measure, oh, let them get through the onboarding experience, and let that be our top metric, when actually that's not the top metric. The top metric is fine if you have drop off, but get the right customer experiencing the right aha moment and form a habit so that you have retention. But we have like really good scores through onboarding, but it's bringing people in that probably aren't really qualified and then be satisfied with the solution we're delivering to them. And so data is nuanced. And I wish data, I don't know if you know this or anyone working on a tool like this, but like, data always tells you what's happening, never why. Why is that happening? What? I don't know if you have any tips around that, but no one wants to talk to you. All these people come through your app and it's so hard to get them to talk to you. Yeah, we pay money to get them to talk to us, but like, yeah, any tips around the data telling you what, but then how do you figure out why did that happen?
I think that you said it. I think data, especially in surface, does never tell you why. But if you dig down below and if you have a vast amount data set, you can even find out why. But the problem with it is that these data sets sometimes are just too big or complex for our human cognitive capacity to extract correlations that can point us to why. And that is the reason why, basically, in the past, we were never able to understand why some movements would happen and so on. That's where AI steps in again, because AI is great at finding out those correlations. Because if I'm able to understand that, for example, I'll make an example with Tinder, the rate of matches that a user has on the number of swipes they give is a very important determinant of the likeliness of that user to stay on the platform or not. What I mean by that is, if I have one match every 10 swipes, it means 9 people out of 10 are not really liking me, or they're not interested in me. My self-esteem goes down. I'm not really going to stay in the platform for long. If I get 9 matches out of 10 swipes, then I'm having a great time and I'm talking to a lot of people. My self-esteem is high. So what I mean by that is that we had to dig deep into understanding why people stayed on the platform with respect to some other cohorts. It was very hard for us to understand why at first. So using AI and finding out these hidden correlations really helped us understanding why. And sometimes the why is very unpredictable or very rooted in something that has nothing to do with technology, which is this, which is related to, for example, the self-esteem that a user has on the platform. If people do not match with me and I spend a lot of time swiping.
But how does the data tell you that? So here's the thing, right? Once I figure out the why, I can speak about the genius that we did, but the sleuthing to find the why is hard. So it's 9 swipes out of 10 and hit matches, we get retention. But in the beginning, you didn't know that, right?
That's like, exactly the point.
You didn't know it. Like, and so how does AI, or how do you sleuth to get closer to finding the truth?
I think, and I recall those days, I think we worked with like assumptions. And we would like craft a number of assumptions and hypotheses, and we'd like reverse engineer to see whether the data was pointing towards one with respect to the others. Because there might be an infinite number of whys related to the fact of why a user will stay more and they don't have a lot of matches back. Maybe it's just related to the notifications they don't get on their phone. Maybe it's related to this or that.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it was a work of trying to test hypotheses. And although back in the day, we were not that advanced with AI, I'm sure now they use it more. But overall, nowadays, AI is a great way to test all of these hypotheses, because in a sense, it can help you to better extract meaning from that data, which is super tough.
We're a big believer in, okay, you have your OKRs, objective and key actions to prioritize your execution. And then you have your metrics and you measure it, what's happening. And then you create hypotheses like you talk about, and then do the testing, intentional testing, what you want to learn to try and hone in on that. We're a big believer in that. So I could see that AI could help you create, formulate, and execute tests faster to learn that. Yeah. But I'm still like, I would love to have a tool that helps us hone in on the why faster, because there's 10 hypotheses and they're all wrong. And then there's another 10 hypotheses, they're all wrong. And then another 10 hypotheses, oh, we finally figured it out. And it's 6 months later and you spent a lot of money.
That's the big challenge, honestly.
Anyways, we got off topic there, but it's like something that...
No, I loved it, because it's really like a tough question to answer, because that's really the holy grail of business, understanding why customers behave that way, why a business goes in one direction with respect to the other.
It's easy when you read the narrative that someone writes in a blog after they've already figured it out.
No That's
one
true.
Shares pain. No one shares the pain to get there. Like, you read these blogs, we went from 0 to 100 million ARR in 1 year. What they don't tell you, and they talk about product-led growth, what they don't tell you is they raised $300 million and they spent $200 million, they wasted $150 million, and they got to $100 million in ARR. But they don't talk about that. They just talk about how the PLG, the product-led growth, and these techniques made us there. But it's not that, it's all good learning, not that simple.
Yeah, I cannot trust like too much like gurus on the internet, because I totally agree with you.
So like in the last year, what have you learned that you like, yeah, that was like a good learning in the last year? I got to talk about that to my clients.
Yeah, I think a great learning over the last years is that traditional companies, which by the way are my biggest customer when it comes to keynotes, have a chance to reinvent themselves in the age of AI. Because I've seen so many great cases and examples. Last year, for example, I gave a keynote at John Deere's dealership summit, and it was amazing to see a company, like a 200 years old company, very traditional, that manufactured farming equipment. I've seen them saying on stage that they don't consider themselves a farming equipment company anymore, but then now they sell intelligence to the customer, to the farmer. And they now have more than 10% of their revenues coming from software sales. So they have all the software to manage the fields and so on. They generate data through IoT. And what I've learned, again, is that something that I believed was not really feasible and possible, because I was seeing all these companies struggling to reinvent themselves and to exit the status quo of things, especially leaders and traditional companies. Is they've had so many successes that it's very tempting to copy and paste those past successes. The point is that this does not necessarily mean they will keep on working in the future. Yeah. And seeing the way that AI has allowed to generate new business models, generate new revenue streams, to generate new products and services, either from R&D labs or sales teams, to not only automate, but augment tasks, namely, again, improving the quality of commercial proposal and not substituting the salesperson. I think that's a great learning, seeing how more feasible it is to reinvent your business and pivot. Something that only startups had until a couple of years ago.
Love it. Because that's a mindset. The mindset is not, oh, let me replace. No, how can I like deliver more, innovate, and have new revenue streams? And I love that mindset, Fava. I love that answer. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, seeing that was really heartwarming in a sense, because you see all of these businesses struggling and now they finally have a tool. But the tool is always a double-edged sword. It really depends on how you use it. And so some other companies are really struggling with it and having disengaged teams that fear AI and are not very well trained, and they spend a lot of money on tools and having complete data. That's also one part of the story.
Yeah, and that's a hurdle. That's common for even the innovative companies. It's everything's happening so fast. It's really like prioritizing the how can we deliver, delight the customer more? How can we think about new innovation on a product or service delivery and thinking along that mindset? It's changing so fast. And even innovative companies now have to reinvent and think positively. But the narrative has to be about collaboration and delivering better value instead of replacement, skill replacement, people replacement. Why is that our narrative? That's not supposed to be the narrative. Like what you just said is not the narrative.
That's exactly. That's the point. I think because it's tempting and it made some movies in Hollywood very successful, like The Terminator and so on. And that's a part of the reason why we always are attracted to the negative outcome and we're afraid of technology. Yeah, I think there are reasons there, but it definitely shouldn't be the narrative. We should twist it, see the positive aspect of it. And there's many, but they're challenging.
This is probably old school, but you're a Johnny Appleseed out there. You need to keep going around giving those keynotes and spreading the different thinking process here, how to make everything better. And so you have an important role that you're playing now. I hope you know that.
I think I agree with you, Dean, and especially also what you do with the podcast and with all the content. I think it's very important to do it nowadays, because maybe you're planting a seed of a mindset shift that I believe is the most important part right now. People have the tools, but it's like driving a Formula One car without having the skills. That will be a disaster. You'd surely crash. And the tool is super powerful. It's like a racing car, but you need some things that serve as the basis. And if we don't build them, I think we're going towards a risky outcome.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, what question didn't I ask you that you wish I would have asked? Is I want to share this point of view or something.
Look, we talked about customer experience, and I've mentioned that I used to work at Groupon. And it's so funny because you've correctly asked me how Tinder was so successful when it came to customer experience. But you didn't ask me yet why Groupon failed. And it was exactly because of poor customer experience. Because I don't know if you've ever used a Groupon back in the days. Was this company was selling discounts and coupons on restaurants.
I never used one, but I know of them. Yeah.
Okay. So it's super funny because most people that use them have bad memories and poor experiences. You'd buy this discount and you'd were promised having a great meal at a great restaurant for half the price. And you'd go to this restaurant and you were like being discriminated. If you would be a Groupon customer, you'd have the worst table close to the bathroom or close to the kitchen. We were so focused in selling as many coupons as possible that we were not really worried about the experience people would have at the restaurant. And the problem is that the more people have bad experiences, the lower their retention, and it's also terrible for the brand. And so our user acquisition costs were raising and raising because you had to convince a lot of people who had bad experiences to come back. And that's very costly to the point that now it's not bankrupt, but I think its stock price is 5% of what it was at IPO. So I think it was an interesting experience and a great learning curve.
Yeah, wrong metrics to measure. We've all done it. Daily active users, for us, we wanted to have 90% people completing the onboarding process. No. Yeah, wrong metric. It's about retention. It's about value and experience. And
exactly. It came to my mind because it was really complimentary to the Tinder story.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you for coming on. This was a great experience for me. And thank you. And if people want to get in touch with you, Andre, how can they do that?
Thank you, Dean. First of all, thank to you for leading this great conversation and for the podcast. If people want to reach out to me, I'm on LinkedIn, Andrea Iorio. Also, my personal website, you can find more information at www.andreaiorio.com. Also, my book has a website. It's called www.betweenyouand.ai. So it's an AI domain, betweenyouand.ai. And just reach out. I love to talk. I love being here. And the more the merrier of these conversations. So thanks again, Dean, for having me on the podcast.
Awesome. Thank you. Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.